Good morning, Inspirata Projector. This is Martha from Martha's Place. I want to tell you thank you so much again for taking time to be on Serenity Sunday. I truly appreciate you. All the best to you always.
Oh, hello there. I'm hiding in a hut. Here you can tell. The sign of the cat drinking water. So, you all have tuned into Inspirato Projecto. Thank you so much. Maria's Place. For inviting me to be on your Serenity Sunday. And for talking about extraordinary things. Thank you. What you're about to hear next is an interview with Mike Schley. He happened to be doing some repairs a la Schneider. Remember, One Day at a Time? He's become the Schneider of Dave Uchansky's building. Dave's sort of the mayor of his building, if you want to call it that. I call it that. I want to call it that. Call him that. Call him that. The mayor. The mayor of his apartment complex. That's what we can do here. This just popped into my brain. I'm being quiet. Why? Because it's 1:17 a.m. on a Monday. I was thinking about this earlier.
Welcome to the Halloween scare of your life, Black Pumpkin. Taking place in 2018, with two kids awakening a demon that they never knew existed until too late. 8888 Black Pumpkin. It's a ride for your life. Starring Ellie Patricios, Ryan Poole, Connor Wheel, Kurt Clendenin, David Uchansky, Ryan McGonagall.
Right when she came out with White Diamonds, this is one of the things that he sent me too. It was when she came out with White Diamonds, she was about 60 years old at the time. And this is what he told me. He goes, we put her in the hospital to go there and have this total body makeover so that way she could look really good when she did her premiere thing for White Diamonds. So they were going to do a photo shoot of her. So she was fucked up all the time, big time drugs, and she was a nympho at the same time. So they had her, after the surgery, had her all healed up and everything, they put her in a bikini, and they were going to do this photo shoot of her, and they had her in a swimming pool, but she was so fucked up that she kept passing out, so they didn't want her to drown. So Lofty gets in the swimming pool with her and holds her up so they could do the photo shoot. And they said they had to do that a lot with Liz Taylor because she was just too jacked up. And if you ever look at like some of those press photos, you can tell nobody's home. So anyway.
So she's like a cardboard cutout. People are just kind of like propping her up. Oh my God. Photoshopping a smile. Right. Weird.
So anyway. So she tells him, hey, I'm hungry. Go get me something to eat. You know, I don't feel too good, blah, blah, blah. And he says, okay. So he takes off. He comes back. What does he find? The publicist and the photographer in the swimming pool with Liz Taylor having a threesome. He comes over. She says, Lofty, come on. Take off your clothes and join in. So he took off his clothes and joined in.
This is crazy.
Yeah.
Liz Taylor.
That's one of the stories he has.
How long has he been sending these crazy transcripts?
About 6 weeks now.
Wow.
Yeah. And I told him, I said, I want to write a book. I'll write the book for you. I also want to make it into a script. Because I think, and I already started the script, and what I'm going to do is, it's going to start out with him dying. But he's not going to die. They have the paddles out there. They're trying to bring him back to life. Right? And they put the sheet over him. Right? And they're walking out. And all of a sudden the EKG thing goes, beep. Beep. And they come in. He's going to confess to the priest. That's what I'm going to have it all about. Is he's going to confess to this damn priest and everything. And this priest is just going to be shell-shocked with all these stories.
Oh, that's great.
Right. And then who's he call? His friend Kevin, which is John's friend. Right? So I'm going to have Kevin,
God.
Where they get the phone call. Hey, Lofty's dying. Right? So then they get the priest in there. He starts spilling his guts. Right? And then Lofty's asleep. Kevin comes in. And they'll say, yeah, man, I think your friend has like mental illness or something because he has these crazy stories. He goes, crazy stories? Man, let me tell you something. You know? And then Kevin will start saying the story.
Oh, that's great.
You know, and like narrating. Hey,
oh, that's
let me tell
awesome.
You the time that Lofty did this.
Oh.
You know, and then the priest is just like.
Then you get know? To see like the young, you get to see the story unfold. Oh,
right.
God, that sounds fun.
So I'm going to do the whole thing like that. And then at the end, what happens? He dies. Okay? He dies. Jackson Brown shows up. Steven Tyler shows up. All these guys. Yeah, I'm glad that son of a bitch is
dead. So they're all trading stories about just how terrible he was.
Right.
Oh, my God. That's so funny.
Yeah. And
he goes,
man, this is going to be great. So that's how the script's going to go.
That's awesome.
And then I asked Kevin. I said, okay, I need two things from you. Okay. What is the one word? I need two words. One word. What describes Lofty in one word? Okay. And what describes his attitude in one word? Okay. I need both those things. He goes, okay. First one is unfiltered. He has no filters. I go, I love that. Guess what the name of the book's gonna be called? Unfiltered.
Oh, that's good.
We're there.
That's good.
Right? I said, okay, now what made him, what was the big thing about him? He goes, chaos. That's his whole life was chaos.
Oh my God.
If it wasn't, you know, he gave me the story about the first time he had sex. He met this girl. They were 13 years old, and he rushed her. They were in a meat market. He met her at the store, so he went into the store, went into the meat market, went in the freezer, in the locker, and banged her in the locker. That's when he lost his virginity, was in the freezer of a meat market. You know, stuff like that. Some of the stories, you just go, what the hell? Because I have a friend of mine that I grew up with. His name, we called him Cheetos. He was a bass player. He played, and because, you know, I was hanging out with musicians all the time. We were all the meddlers at that time. Cheetos was crazy. Cheetos playing a gig, he'd light his armpits on fire.
Oh my God.
You know, stuff like that.
Oh my God.
You know, pull down his pants and like rip a big one and, you know, have a flame over there, a big old mushroom cloud coming out of his ass up on stage. I don't know how many times the guy got arrested. Anyway, he ended up making it big over in New York, you know, because he was crazy. Crazy. And now, lo and behold, after all these years, he ended up being a dancer on Broadway. And he was gay. And we had no idea, you know, but it's kind of like the same story with this guy, Lofty. And I'm just like, man. And then the story that Chrisman told me, my friend Jim. And I go, I heard the story from Lofty. He goes, and I heard it from you. So I have validation on this stuff because Jim was right there too. Yeah, because they were together on the tour doing this shit. And I'm just like, oh my God. Okay, because I knew these stories before I heard them from Lofty. And then I tell Lofty about them. Yeah, man, how about that time, blah, 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 blah. He goes, how did you know that story? I go, Jim Chrisman? He goes, Jim, what did he look like? I said, little glasses, about 6'1", blonde hair, really thin. Had a Philadelphia accent. He goes, oh, Jim! Yeah, I remember Jim. Oh, my God. You know, and then he'll tell me stories about what, because Jim was nuts, too. Yeah.
Dude, Jim, so you could Jim have it all about shit. These crazy misfits, you know, these guys. And you think about it, like a guy with the name Lofty, you know, Lofty is this word where it's just very imagination-filled, very lofty, yeah. Very like, and it sounds like this guy is very, like, he just kind of flew by the seat of his pants. It sounds to me like he just kind of went where the wind...
Still does.
How old is this guy?
He's now 67, and he's on his deathbed. He's dying, and he's still living the same way.
Oh my
God. He doesn't care. I'm going to go the way I want to go, and that's it. I'll still be crazy. And he is. He's still a nut. And then, you know, I want to know what made him tick. What made you into what you did, how you were? And he had a crazy uncle. And the crazy uncle, this back in the early 70s, did some stupid shit and taught him everything. Then his mom was a total slut. Yeah. Dad was out of the picture. And then, you know, he saw mom over there banging guys and all kinds of weird shit. So it became normal to him. And it's just an amazing journey. So I'm working on that with him right
now.
That's
incredible.
Yeah.
So he'll send you the transcripts. And then I'm sure from what you've seen already, you're kind of connecting the dots in your brain. Right. Like, ooh, this could go here and this could be fun here.
I'm doing it in chronological order. Okay, because that's the best way to do it. You know, when the priest comes in, okay, well, let's start at the beginning. Okay, when I was 4 years old, I saw my mom over there, you know, getting butt-fucked by some dude, you know. Okay, uncle, you know, those kind of stories. You know, and then it goes back to the first time he got laid, you know, in the freezer. You know, that'll be its own chapter right there, you know, right there. Because I have one of the chapters I named it, Girls Have Vaginas. Because that's what changed his life was when he found that out. That changed his life. Because then after that, he didn't care about anything else. He just wanted to be the craziest son of a bitch who got laid all the time. And he didn't care if he went to jail. He beat people up, fight all the time. You know, some of the stories... You know, where thank God he had friends that actually cared about him, because he probably shouldn't have lived several of the times. Yeah.
Wow.
And a lot, right there on Hollywood Boulevard, most of the time it was right there. He grew up in Southgate, but did all his damage here in Hollywood.
Oh my gosh.
He was in a band. He was in his had his own band, and he did all this crazy stuff in the band, and then ended up roading for everybody on Under the Sun.
Kiss and Motley Crue?
Kiss, Motley Crue, Aerosmith, Jackson Brown.
This is just crazy.
I mean, all these people. Just, yeah. And it's like Jim, my friend Jim. Jim, when he was the sound guy, he was out there with Kiss, Motley Crue. He did the Barney Show. He was the sound guy for the Barney Show. One of his best friends on the planet is Brian Setzer.
Wow.
Yeah. Every time that Brian has a concert, because Brian doesn't do a lot of concerts. He only does like those Christmas specials and whatever else, even though he is going out with the Stray Cats again.
Wow. Wow.
Like in the next few months.
That's so I'm not awesome.
Sure. I have to find out if Jim's going to do that. But every time Brian calls him up, hey, man, you're on board. And he gets him out there. And
he becomes the sound guy?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
At one time, he was working with me. And I go, hey, Jim, you know, he goes, hey, man, I got to take off for a couple weeks. I go, man, you can't take off for a couple weeks. You know, what are we going to do? He says, I don't care. He goes, Brian called me. He goes, they need me in Amsterdam.
Oh, my God.
He goes, they're doing a big big special thing. Oh. It's going to be on TV, and they need me to do the sound.
Amazing.
So, yeah, he says, he offered me 15 grand.
Oh, boy.
I was like, okay, bye, Jim. Have a nice time. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, Jim was amazing. He ended up screwing everybody and messing up everybody in the whole industry.
And still, he still has these friends who
not anymore. He's losing everybody. That's what Jim. What's
like, for instance, with Brian Setzer, it's like
Brian will still, yeah, he's still okay with
it's
Brian.
It's crazy how there are those ones who do match up with these guys, right? And then those who just like yeah. You're saying, Jackson Brown, whoever else, they just
yeah. Jackson Brown can't stand him because he did. He blew up their soundboard right before one of the gigs, and they couldn't play.
God.
And they had to get another soundboard in there. Yeah, yeah. It was Lofty did oh some of the shit. I'll send you some of the transcripts. You have to read some of the stuff. When you just read, you just go
what man?
What? Yeah. And then Karen was the nut. That was the love of his life. You know, he's married to somebody else right now, but Karen was his equal, but wow. A female version.
Wow.
Yeah. He said, you know, I don't know how many times I'd come home and she's in bed with three different guys. You know, this is my girlfriend. You know, I go, what'd you do about it? He goes, joined them. What else can I do? Yeah. You know, stuff like that. That's how he was. Yeah. Yeah, you'll love this stuff.
This is so interesting.
Yeah.
You got the scoop on this. How cool is that? This untold story. Ernie Kanzler sounds like another good one to do a story.
Ernie wants to be really bad.
Because you haven't met him yet?
I haven't met him.
Oh my gosh,
no, but
you
we're
guys
soulmates.
Are like,
I already know we're
soulmates. Yeah, you guys.
We're on the same plane when it comes to what's happening in the real reality, not what we see, what your eyes don't see. You know, then I just talked to Gary. Gary's another one. Gary was the executive producer for Corey Haim's last movie. He's done about 8 movies. He's a friend of mine, the Hollywood producer. He wants to do the Anunnaki story really
bad. Oh.
And he had $10 million stashed away to do this recently. And he was bugging me to write the script for it. Really bad. I named it Anki and the Golden Umbrella. That's the name of it. And it's Indiana Jones meets the Da Vinci Codes.
Wow.
That's how I'm writing it. So you get all the crazy stuff, but the U.S. government is the Nazis.
So your buddy has money ready to rock and roll to put out... Uh-oh, what happened?
He had it in stocks. A friend of mine... I told you about Joe, Chinese Joe. He's an inventor.
Oh, yeah.
Well, they got screwed big time. The company that... Joe sold his patent to this company for 15 million future shares. Okay? Well, what happened was... They put a freeze on his shares. He couldn't sell. He couldn't do anything with the shares. What they did is they sold the company out from underneath themselves. The CEO and whoever the bigwigs are gutted the company. without Joe getting a dime out of it, and now the company's defunct. The stock went from $3.80 a share to, last time he told me, it was 0.2 cents. That's how far it's gone down per share. So he basically, his 15 million shares went from being worth, what was it, almost $48 million to being worth about $60,000 because of what they did. And now he got subpoenaed by the U.S. government. And he's going to have to go in October and testify in Washington, my friend Joe.
Against the company
the
that...
The company that did this, yeah. And what he did is they have a law, okay? They have a law that you can only have so much... You can't have that much control in a company. Mm. Because he had 35% as a single entity. You can do it as a corporation, you can do it like that, yeah. But you can't do it by yourself. So what Joe did was he broke up the shares. And, he had 30 million shares. 30 million shares they got for it. He took 10 million for himself. He gave Gary 10 million shares. He was basically running this little corporation. And then put 10 million shares in his sister's account. So that way he wouldn't get busted by the government by having kind of a monopoly type of thing. So he told Gary, use that money to make movies. And that's when Gary came to me. He goes, I saw your Mohawk Mike story because I gave it to his wife. She's a producer. Mm. And she loved it. She took it to Nickelodeon and Disney.
Wow.
And they're like, make a couple changes and we like it. That's what they said. Whoa. So Gary read it. He's like, whoa. Because Gary didn't believe I was a writer. I gave him my book. And he's like, yeah, you can write a book, but can you write a script? Then he saw my script. He's like, oh, you can write a script. Then he came to me and said, hey, please do me a favor. I've been trying for 15 years to write the Anunnaki story. Hollywood says no, because it throw religion in the trash.
Oh, boy.
And he goes, but if we self-produce it, Hollywood can't say a fucking thing. And I said, cool. He goes, I got the 10 million shares. Mike, join on board. Come on, let's do this. Oh. He goes, I love your idea about making it in the Da Vinci Code. And, he goes, man. I go, yeah, it'll be an action adventure. That's what it'll be. And you have the government trying to undermine everybody.
Hi. Right.
Hello.
Hi.
You okay?
No.
You cold?
Yeah.
Uh-oh. Let's see. Hold on, let me... Okay. You're too cold? Hold on, let me...
So,
Let me shut this off.
So anyway, all this stuff happened in the last 3 months. So Gary told me, he says,
that won't be as cold now.
Yeah, he says, put the script on hold. There's nothing I can do. And I go, no, I'm going to keep going with it. I'll get it done. You know, go out there and try to find the money. You know, he just had, he's trying to do, right now, it's called You've Got the Part. And it's, I disagree with his format, but he wants it so you could literally go on your phone and audition for a part in a movie off your phone. And then they interview, or then they review all the people that are trying out for the part, and then they'll do callbacks.
Mm.
Instead of you actually showing up and reading for the part, you do it over the phone.
Oh.
So he's trying to put this together, but you go, Gary, you need a lot more than that, you know. Anybody can go there and read lines off the phone and make it sound good, but can they actually act? Different story. And he had he wasted about $500,000 on that recently. And I told him, I said, man, make it into a show. Put it in a show. And then you say, okay, here's the carrot at the end of the thing. We have a movie we're doing, and you have to read for the part. And we're going to take the best person for that part for this part, the best person for that part, the best person for this part. Mm. And then... if you have this show, then you have these people, they're interested in it. They want to see the movie because they see them auditioning the parts.
Oh, that's good.
And then
good.
Put everything together at the end. And he squandered the money trying to do the online thing.
Mm.
And I was like, oh, Gary. Then he went fishing and he got $10 million to do a detective movie. And he got somebody else to write it. And they had, they tried to get Wesley Snipes to do it. Because he's in big trouble with the IRS and everything. So they can get him cheap. And he said, no. He said, I want big money. Right? So they got Cuba Gooding Jr. to do the part instead. And fell apart again. And he's like, man, I'm almost done, Mike. He says, I can't get anything done. You know, and He does. He's...
He needs to get you to write a story. I mean, you already have stuff written. Like, why can't you just go, I love what you did. Let's just... I'll just go ahead and fund that and let's...
Yeah. And he has the money to do it. He just wants to use other people's money.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah. Because, you know, why... Let somebody else take the risk. Let them do it.
I always like that idea, though. Like, if you believe enough in your vision, in your project, that's the best kind of gambling you could ever do. Because
That's what David Lean used to do. Dr. Zhivago, Lawrence of Arabia. He'd spent 3 years putting together the package, doing all the development, have everything done for when they did that movie. Guess who owned the movie? David Lean. It was his movie. He made it himself. He did the whole works. He brought in the team, says, okay, this is what we're going to do. And everything was prepared. They shot those damn movies in less than 2 weeks.
Wow.
Because he spent 3 years doing all the development. Wow. They knew how everything was going to be shot before it was even shot. You know, that's what John was trying to do with Black Pumpkin. He got so much resistance from Ryan and Shada. And you know, when he... That one day that you saw the storyboards.
His storyboards are awesome. So good.
So good. It tells the whole damn story.
Yeah.
It's a comic book. You know, you want to nail that stuff before you even go into development. You know, that's part of development. You know, you don't just go in there and say, okay, where are we going to put the camera now? No, you know where that camera's going to go. You know, when you did your the scene with the couch up there in Ray's loft. You know, he knew exactly where the camera was going to be. And he knew what Dan was going to do before Dan even showed up. When Dan showed up, he's like, oh, yeah, I got this. You know, that's all the preparation ahead of time. You know, we do that a lot. I sit down with John all the time. We're going through shit like this. You know, I wish you were closer by.
Me too.
I'm looking for somebody to do development with. Because we're having a hard time with development right now.
What do you mean, like, for meaning what? For what parts?
Okay, this is what we're doing. Is he has one of Rick Elfman's he has the rights to
Trio brilliant script,
love it. He has the rights to it. He's going to try to get Richard to direct it, which I think would be perfect. Mm-hmm. He's the one who wrote it. Get him to direct it. You know, who knows the story better than he does? He has another one that's an amazing story. He wrote this back in 1998. He wants me to go through it again. It's a story about the U.S. government back in the 1850s thought they were smart, and they brought over all these camels to California back in the 1850s. And they found out that the California deserts are made out of rock, and camels are used to being in sand. And it hurt the feet like crazy, and these camels became like very rebellious and mean.
No wonder they're stepping on these rocks all day, and oof.
And they would go kill their riders and everything else because they're a violent animal.
Oh boy!
Right. So anyway, he wrote this story about an Indian girl who gets killed by one of the camels. Way in the past, okay. Lo and behold, what happens? They find the little girl's bones. They find all this stuff in, like, today.
Oh.
Right? And somebody else dies the same way.
Oh,
like
boy.
Like a camel. It's like the murderer came back after 130 years.
Wow.
Type of thing. Well, ends up, yeah, it was a camel. But the camel was because there was a crash on the freeway. Okay, and the camel got out because it was in one of those like horse trailers, okay, and it's all the Frankenstein stuff, the lynch mob and we're gonna get the monster, and the heroes are the park rangers because they're out there in the middle of the desert. There's nobody else.
Oh my god!
And lo and behold, the one park ranger, she goes, okay, I got the monster, and she walks in with the camel, and the way the story goes, it's like Fargo. Fargo and Frankenstein mixed together.
Oh, that's cool.
You know, the way he wrote it, I was like, man, this is good. So he has that one that he wants me to go through. Then the football story. I think he told you about that one.
No, he didn't tell me about
Cumberland
football story.
College. In 1916, Cumberland College played Georgia Tech in a football game and lost 222-0. Okay?
Whoa.
It's one hell of a story. And it has John Heisman in it from the Heisman Trophy.
Wow.
John Heisman was the coach of Georgia Tech. Okay? And the story is unreal because they've tried to make the movie three times. Okay? They went to Cumberland College. They had the rights to Cumberland College. They were going to give them the football field. They were going to give them the whole place for free to shoot the movie there because they want the story to be made also. They went to Georgia Tech. Georgia Tech said, yes, we're on board too. We want the story made. They had everybody in place, and it fell apart. The funding went away because of the financial crisis. Okay? So he... And this story is tremendous because the main guy who's in charge at Cumberland College ended up working for four different presidents in the White House. So you have this backstory. You have a backstory about this person, plus John Heisman. You know how they came up with the Heisman Trophy?
How?
John Heisman was the biggest prick and biggest asshole, right? So as a joke, for the best football player in the nation, they made a trophy of him.
So it was just an inside joke the whole time. It was a big joke. This guy's a big jerk. Let's make a trophy in honor of this big jerk. Oh my God, dude. Okay. So when you win the Heisman, it's more of like a practical joke kind of award is basically, right?
That's what it is.
And yet people don't even realize that's what's going on.
They have no clue. Yeah.
It's like, he won the Heisman Trophy. Oh my God.
And
that is so funny.
And they tried to pull all these strings, trying to get this, and all the things that they had to do. They stole the uniforms from the local high school because they didn't have a football team. The president of the university was trying to shut down their athletic program at the time, and he was trying to save it. That's why they scheduled the game against Georgia Tech, because at that time there was no athletic director. It was a student body president who was in charge of the athletics.
Oh my God!
And that was this guy. His name was George, forgot his name, George something. Yeah, but he was the student body president. He tried to recruit black athletes. This is 1916. Oh, no, you can't have black athletes, because Jackie Robinson was 30 years away. And he ended up getting the announcer to play in the game. He had all these weird people because he didn't have enough people to play, and they played this game, and they ended up getting their butts kicked 222-0.
Wow. But
yeah, it's a great story. And he had everything, that's one of the stories. Then he has, he has six. And then I have my six. So we have 12 together, plus I have eight more in here.
Oh my God.
That I haven't even started yet.
Oh my God.
Well, I've started every one of them. I've done like the first three or four pages. Just so I know where it's going.
Oh, that's good.
But the story's here. Then this guy, Kevin, Lofty's friend. And matter of fact, I need to talk to Kevin about this. John says, I got a good one for you. I said, what? He goes, Kevin got invited to a birthday party. I said, so? He goes, guy's been dead for 2 years. I went, oh, man. And he goes, I knew you'd do that. I knew you'd do that. And I go, instead of 2 years, it's 12 years now.
It's 12
12 years now. And now there's five people. And this woman, she's dying.
Oh, my God.
Okay? And she's going to invite these people. A mistress, his best friend in school, his ex-business partner. And they're all going to go to this house. Okay? And she's going to find out which one of them caused the most damage to him during his lifetime.
Oh, boy.
Before she passes.
Whoa.
And it's going to be this Agatha Christie type of thing.
Wow.
All in one house with six people, maybe a butler.
Wow. Right? Yeah.
And you can do it on like no budget at all because all they're doing is talking inside the house.
Yeah.
Like the Breakfast Club.
Ooh, right? I love it.
I'm going to do it like the Breakfast Club. So,
That's cool.
So that's one of the stories that I have in there. Final Instinct, the one that I sent you a couple months ago.
Oh,
that one's amazing.
Oh my God,
what's gonna happen there? Because it's all gonna tie into a video game.
Oh God, that's so good. Yeah. That is so good.
Because the guys are gonna go, oh my God, everything that's happening right now is in the video game. What the hell?
Oh my God.
And you have this whole thing going on. You have like this like video game culture that's like jumping in and saying, what the hell's going on? They're mimicking the video game. And all this stuff. And then his mom is like the main person. And what I did, the opening scene, I turned Alexa into Chucky.
That's great.
That's how I started. The first six pages is this crazy ass thing where Alexa's over attacking this lady and her boyfriend.
Oh my god.
But they're in their 20s at the time. Then the whole thing goes back, you know, from 2018 to 2047.
Oh my god.
All the robotic era, the suppression, everything, you know, flying drones, you know, all the CGI stuff that would have to go in 2047 and have it all tie in with the video game.
Oh my god.
Final Extinction.
Incredible.
That's the name of the video game.
Oh my
god. And the way I put it all together, and John's like, oh my god, Mike. I said, he goes, that's one of those $200 million ones. I said, I know. What are we going to do with it?
I know.
You know, he goes, write it. And I says, it's here. I got to do it. You know, yeah.
We got to I saw online today on Twitter, there's this guy who said he's a film financier. And so I sent a, you know, message, and I sent him the trailer, the Black Pumpkin trailer. And I said, you're a financier, I noticed, on your thing. Do you like horror films and stuff like that? He's like, oh, contact me at the office. And I'm like, at the office? And I looked on his Twitter account, and it was something for, it was called Tele Canada or something like that. Well, I ended up finding out that they finance movies in Canada, this company. Yeah. And so then it started getting me thinking, like, okay, I know two girls from last year's Kapow who live in Canada. My buddy Jimmy lives out in Canada. And I'm thinking, like, and I already start thinking of ways, like, in my brain of, like, okay, I know these actors live out there. What would be a way that we could get this, you know, get a movie going out there, get the financing going for that?
Toronto. Toronto's the new Hollywood. Toronto and Atlanta.
Man.
Yeah. The films that are being made in Toronto, so much cheaper than doing it here. And they just, and you have all the people there. It's just like Hollywood over in Toronto now. Same with Atlanta. You go to Atlanta, you don't need Hollywood anymore. Hollywood's become a shell of itself. It really has. The Arabs have taken over. Yeah, I hate to say
that. Well, this is the thing that I noticed is that, Hollywood used to be the center. Like, this was the only place to go for the entertainment, everything.
This is it.
But as more and more power is taken away, more and more of that monopoly is taken away from the bigwigs, from, yeah, you know, oh, you can only shoot a movie if you have this studio or that studio. Well, now, guess what? There's that camera, the Black Magic, I keep reading about. It's this beautiful, beautiful, it's like a $4,000 or $5,000 camera. But whoa, it's like crispy. It's this 4K quality, really, really good, which an everyday person can have. So if you live in freaking Nebraska, if you live out in Wisconsin, you can actually shoot movies, and you totally do not need any. You don't need Hollywood. You don't need these big. It's beautiful. It's so exciting.
It's a new renaissance. This whole thing, you know, especially with now Netflix and Hulu, and now Disney jumping on board, and Prime and everything else. It's a new renaissance. You know, when Netflix says that they're going to spend $8 billion on new content in 2018, and you see it all over the billboards, you know, they're coming out with show after show after show, movie after movie after movie, and they're funding all this stuff because they're building their library. That's all they're doing. You know, Disney, Turner bought out MGM Grand or MGM. That's how they started the Turner Movie Network or Movie Channel. They bought out MGM, so they bought the whole catalog of movies. Now you have you don't have to pay royalties. You don't have to pay shit. You own everything. You know, Disney's doing the same thing. They're trying to buy Paramount right now. Disney wants to buy Paramount's whole library. Okay, NBC. That's the reason why NBC bought Universal Studios, so for their library. They can care less about the tour. Look at the money they're going to make off all of those old movies. Every time Frankenstein's on TV, they get a paycheck. You know, 1931. You know, and that's how it works.
I'm so surprised you don't see a hell of a lot more crossovers with these things. More crossovers. Like whatever TV shows that NBC has, why doesn't Frankenstein just go ahead and show up? Why doesn't The Mummy show up? Why doesn't Dracula? You know, like, why not utilize that? You know, it seems so crazy to me that they're not, that isn't something they've tried to do yet.
They're afraid. John and I talk about this all the time. It's pure fear. That's why they're bringing back Magnum P.I., and they're bringing back Charmed, and they're bringing back, you know, all this stuff that worked before. They just reboot it as something else, and they just throw that name out there because the name sold before. And they're afraid. They're purely
afraid. It's a sure bet, so to speak, right?
Yeah. Because all those old people, like Hawaii Five-0, when that came out, I just went, really? It's not even like Hawaii Five-0. You're just stealing the name and shooting this thing in Hawaii. Okay? Magnum P.I. is a Mexican dude now.
Well, he doesn't even have a mustache. Yeah, that poster dude doesn't even have his mustache. Like, come on, guy.
Yeah. You know, now they're bringing back Charmed. Okay? Come on.
You know what's so funny? It's like, they'll rely on those. It's like they're resting on their laurels on these for sure things until they see someone else out there take a risk and it becoming phenomenal and them going, ooh, and now they're salivating. And now they're going, oh, gosh, what can we do now to compete with that? Oh, gosh, they're doing Westworld over there. Oh, what can we do? You know, so then all of a sudden they're like, it's weird. It's so strange to see how that stuff works. Yeah. And it's usually a lot of times it's the independent films that are doing that. It's the people who don't have the money because...
Yeah.
When you're low on funding, the creativity really stretches.
It does.
So you could do some really clever stuff like that. And I think like when these companies see, like for instance, a kid on YouTube who's got his own channel and he's got 3 million viewers and he's making all this money, they're going, we didn't make that amount of money on the last film that we did, yet here's this little 6-year-old playing video games making all this money. What are we doing wrong? Oh, I know what we need to do now. We need to make movies that are more YouTube-looking. Let's make them more YouTube-looking. Yeah. Maybe that's where the secret is. Oh, yeah, okay, guys, get on that. You know, it's like, it's so weird. It's so strange when you can see...
Wreck-It Ralph.
I have not seen that yet.
Wreck-It Ralph. Watch Wreck-It Ralph. That is the epitome of what you're talking about. You know, it is. It's basically a kid that goes into a video game. But it's animated. And the video game talks to him about what's going on and blah, blah, blah. You know, and you just go, whoa, okay.
Wait, so it's like, in a sense, it's an educational, showing.
No, it's like.
Is like a They
YouTube,
Live kind of thing?
It's like going on YouTube and watching somebody else playing video games.
Oh.
Because that's a big thing now.
Yeah, it really is. It totally is.
Huge.
Yeah.
You know, like the Madden tournament where those two kids died. That was all streamed online. You can sit there and watch it. My daughter's boyfriend, she has a boyfriend now, legitimate boyfriend. He's a good guy.
Oh, good, good.
No problems with him. Love him to death. That's what he does. He plays video games for money. He goes, he plays in these tournaments.
Incredible.
He's online. You can watch him play. And he's there, and he has a microphone, headset, and he's explaining everything he's doing. And people, he has, I forgot how many thousands of followers he has, and then they pay him. Because he has so many followers.
Incredible.
Yeah. He has an income. He makes about $1,800 a month. He's 17 years old.
Just playing video games.
Playing video games. So sometimes Sam will go there and she'll tell me. She goes, Dad, I wanted to go see Tanner, but, you know, he's working. I go, oh, okay. I go, well, go see him anyway. You can sit there and watch him play video games just like everybody else.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's what he does.
It's interesting how... Just that act of watching someone else do something, there's something comforting about that. Like, strangely enough, it's become that way. You know, like reality television, just people live their lives.
Yeah.
Or the TV show Big Brother, and they get their 24-hour, you know, they pay a subscription to see it stream 24 hours and go on there and go, oh, I see the people sleeping. Oh,
like
look at that.
EdTV? Wasn't it EdTV?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
EdTV, when they did a movie on that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and it's like... It's so interesting. It's becoming this thing of like...
Instead of living your own life, because nobody leaves their doors anymore. Everybody's inside their house. You can't afford to do anything. You can't go to a movie. It costs $100 to go to a movie and take you and your date. You know, what gets me is I love watching the sporting events. There's nobody in the stands.
Wow, interesting.
Not a lot of people in the stands. StubHub Center. My mom lives right across StubHub Center. Took a bus over there. During the one of the preseason Chargers games. It was $180 for parking.
What?
$180
just
for
parking. Just to park?
$180 for parking.
Was it more than to buy a ticket to see the thing?
Yeah. But if you want the preferred parking next to the stadium, it was $180 for parking. If you park 2 miles away, it was $50.
Oh, my
God. This is capitalism at its worst. Oof. You know... Here you have, they're playing in a stadium that holds 32,000 people and they're only getting 18,000. What's that telling you? Your prices are too high. Yeah.
God. But it's crazy. Yeah.
But it's that way, you know. Kidado, my sister's girlfriend, she's gay. She told me, she says, Mike, hurry up and make some money off one of your scripts, because I really want to go see LeBron James play in a Laker uniform, but the cheapest tickets for the nosebleed seats are $185. That's the nosebleed seats. And she says, I can't afford it. And I said, no, nobody can. All goes back to, you were in Chicago, Michael Jordan, when they opened up the United Center. That's what it all came down to, was when they were playing at the old Chicago Stadium, right? And then they built the United Center. And it was funny because I had a job offer at that time to move to Chicago.
Oh, wow.
And part of it was a great offer. They offered me to, they were going to buy my condo.
Wow.
They were going to buy my condo. They were going to give me two season tickets that were fourth row from the floor of Michael Jordan's Bulls.
Wow.
And they were going to pay me $125,000 a year.
Holy cow.
That's a job. North Chicago, right on Lake Michigan. It was in the middle of winter, and I said no. But anyway, when I looked at those tickets, there wasn't one ticket when they opened up the United Center that was available to the everyday public.
Real quick, would you like some more wine?
Oh.
Wait, you got to get your phone, right?
Or no? Yeah, I got to get my phone. I got to open the switch in a minute. Oh, you want to talk to me?